supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Bullying. We've heard more and more about it in the news. Victims are mostly young school-age children, and they can experience it as a minefield of teasing, taunting, ostracism, and sometimes even physical harm. Studies show that while bullies themselves act tough, their actions are often a tool to conceal their own shame or anxiety, or to boost self-esteem by demeaning others. Research just published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry points to victims of bullying at school and bullies themselves as being significantly more likely to experience psychiatric problems in childhood, things like anxiety, panic disorders, depression, suicidal ideation. On today's show, we're going to be talking about bullying's many forms, its cultural roots, and when and how and if to intervene with two guests, Emily Bazelon and Charles Williams. Bazelon's a senior editor at Slate. She's the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She joins us by phone. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Chuck Williams is an educational psychologist. He's an associate teaching professor of psychology and the Department of Psychology at Drexel, and he's here in the studio. Chuck, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we're taking your calls about bullying. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Emily, I just saw you on the Colbert Report and listened to you on Fresh Air. You're really doing a wonderful job with the subject matter. But I do have to say, you called Colbert a bully?
I didn't actually call him a bully. I said that he does sometimes bully people. And I think sometimes his questioning in character, which of course is all in good fun, does make people feel intimidated. And I pointed out to him that he is a big, powerful TV host and his guests are at his mercy. But I actually deliberately didn't call him a bully because I think that the label, the idea that this is your whole identity, suggests that it's kind of permanently affixed to you. And I resist that notion.
Let me ask you a bigger context. Bullying has been around forever, probably since we were in caves. But has it always been this aggressive, insensitive, dangerous?
You know, when you look at surveys over the last 25 years in lots of different countries, the rates of bullying are not rising. And it used to be the kids beat each other up much more than they tend to now. But I think what's happening now in the rise of the internet era is that there's just a sense that bullying can be pervasive and 24/7, and that kids don't get a break when they get home from school. That's from the point of view of the targets. And then I think from the point of view of kids who bully, there's something desensitizing about going online. You're not looking at someone face-to-face. You have fewer cues to feel empathy for the person you're targeting. And it can be very easy to push send without really thinking through the consequences. And that, unfortunately, hits kids in a developmental weak spot because the parts of their brains that are less mature are the parts that deal with impulse control.
Right. Right. Chuck, I want to understand what bullying is and, more important, what it's not. Because, you know, with this publicity, you know, it's that label, it's, oh, you're a bully and you need intervention.
And that's an important part of this conversation, because once we started really talking about this in the media, a proliferation of media reports usually related to suicides of young children who, in some part, were encouraged to suicide because of some type of bullying behavior. You know, I get phone calls and emails often, and I have to say to parents and teachers and counselors that every inappropriate act of aggression perpetrated by a child, particularly in a school setting, to another child, isn't bullying. And it may be inappropriate and wrong, but it's not bullying. Bullying is persistent. There is, on the part of the perpetrator, a need to see someone harm. So there's like a sadistic component. They enjoy that psychological power. They enlist their peers, their bystanders. I know Emily writes about that as well. So not all inappropriate social aggression or physical aggression is bullying. We have to be very clear about that.
Emily, I want to pick up on what Chuck said about your experience. And in your book, you said you'd never been bullied, but you were ostracized. Isn't that a form of bullying? You know, Chuck Harris and Dylan Klebold, who shot those children at Columbine High School, they weren't bullied per se, but they were ostracized.
I think exclusion, when it's chronic, in the way Chuck was outlining, and involves the kind of power imbalance Chuck was talking about, can be a form of bullying, and it's one that girls are more prone to participate in, and I think that's what happened to me in eighth grade. That's true.
And long-term scarring from that?
Well, so this is the tricky thing, right? I mean, you referred to this new study that Duke did, which is really important because it showed that for some people who experience bullying as children, and especially for people who are both bullies and victims, that's a category that is associated with more serious problems, there really can be these long-term psychological consequences of higher rates of anxiety and depressive disorders. But, you know, for a lot of people, and this is true of me, there is resilience, and people do bounce back and are able to deal with episodes of adversity in their lives.
And you're in the majority.
Right, and we're exactly. The problem is we're no good at predicting which kids are going to be, you know, really set back by this experience and which kids will go on to recover. And the minority of kids, there is increasing evidence, we really do have to be concerned about in the long term.
Chuck, you got a look on your face that you want to challenge that about not being able to predict.
Well, I think this goes back to our larger discussion about mental health and violence, and of course bullying is a part of that. There are certain indicators, corollaries, so we can't necessarily say that it will lead definitely to these depressive episodes and chronic mental health issues throughout the lifespan. But we know, for example, if a child is being bullied and she's growing up in a home where there is inappropriate aggression, family violence, where there are fewer supports, where there isn't an enriched home environment, where she may show signs of problems in behavior or learning, that she may be more likely to be susceptible to lifelong mental health issues related in part to bullying. It goes back to the diathesis stress model, not to get all scientific about it, but we know that sometimes but people can come into this world with certain temperaments and personalities which predispose them to be susceptible to these kinds of challenges, bullying notwithstanding. So we do know some things about
it. I want to go to the phones. We've got Rose on the line who might be able to weigh in on this issue. Hey, Rose.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to call in because when I was in sixth grade, my family moved to a new town, and all through the sixth grade, I was bullied and ostracized. And as I look back on that, I think the thing that made it such a horrible experience for me was that I had no adult in my life who provided a message to me that was different than the bullying. Like, the adults in my life weren't bullying me, but they weren't counteracting that bullying with a different message.
And what was the impact, when you look back, what was the impact short-term and long-term?
Well, I mean, I have struggled seriously with depression for about 20 years, have often been suicidal. And in the short term, it made it so much harder as I moved we moved again the next year, and going to other new schools, trying to find my own identity to have a sense of myself as a valuable person was so impossibly hard. And I think I don't trust, like, I didn't trust my parents to stand up for me after that experience.
So this all happened at lots of levels. You didn't get anybody to counter what the bullies were saying to you. It was
right.
a new environment. And, you know, I'm looking, this happened in sixth grade, seventh grade. It's right when you're going into puberty and, you know, your identity, body image, everything is up in the air. And all these things happened at once. You say you've had a 20-year history of depression and been suicidal. Do you pin that on these events around puberty?
I think it's complicated, but, you know, as I look, I've been in therapy, and as I've looked at these things, I think a lot of it centers on that moment in my life. It was just such a pivotal moment. But to receive the message that I'm not valuable, and I really, really took that into my head. I really thought that if I were a more worthwhile person, that not only would the kids not have bullied me, but that somebody, some adult, you know, my teachers, my leaders at church, my parents, my grandparents who I lived with, would have stepped up and helped me.
Rose, I have to ask before we turn to our experts, how's your relationship with you today?
It comes and goes. And there are times when I very much am my biggest enemy, when I really hate myself. Right now, I'm actually doing pretty good, but it comes and goes.
Yeah, like most other things. Chuck, you have any thoughts about what we're hearing from Rose?
I think that Rose hits on a very important point, and maybe Emily would agree with me. I think the important part of this conversation that we often leave out is the role and the influence and the power of adults. And what we do know is that far too many adults who are educated just like all of us here feel that bullying is not that harmful and it's a rite of passage, and they will be complicit in bullying. When I talk about this issue now around the country to middle school, high school students, elementary school students, they'll often say the teacher was there or the coach was there or, you know, or some adult knew about it and really did nothing.
Rose, I want to thank you for your call. And just to underscore something is that relationship with you is critical. And when you are not happy with yourself, please know that that woman, that girl, is suffering at the moment, and she needs compassion. Just at the moment you're beating yourself up is when you need kindness more than anything. After all, you're just suffering. Emily, did you want to weigh in on this issue?
Well, I agree with Chuck. And Rose, thank you for calling. That was really a moving account of the effect that bullying can have. One of the studies that really dismayed me when I was doing my research was that when you ask kids who've been bullied if they told an adult at school, most of them say no. And then among the ones who did, most of them say that their situations did not improve. So that suggests, as Chuck was saying, that there's a lot of work to be done here in terms of how adults deal with this problem. And this is the flip side to the problem of people seeing bullying in every conflict and fight and applying the label too much. We have kind of both that happening and the problem of adults still needing to really realize this is a serious issue.
Yeah, looking to find our center. You were just listening to Emily Bazelon. She's written Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying, and that's what we're talking about today with her and Chuck Williams, who's an associate teaching professor of psychology at Drexel, and this is his area of expertise. Our number is 888 800-800-9499. If you were bullied or your child was bullied or if you're concerned about it, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Emily, I want to pick up on what you just said. You talk about three people in your book, and that's kind of how you track through this culture of bullying. I want to talk about Monique for a minute. She was the girl you described in your book who was bullied so badly, her mother had to take her out of school. This was reported to the principal, and he told the kids not to do it. It made things worse. And then the assistant principal suggested peer mediation, but in this case, that made things worse. And finally, her mother and grandmother started speaking out at school board meetings, and things got even worse. So tell us, what was everybody doing wrong?
Right. This is a sad story. The principal you mentioned did not have a lot of authority at this school. And so when he told the kids who really were bullying Monique over a long period of time to cut it out, they didn't listen to him. And so by failing to nip it in the bud and then showing that they could succeed in defying him, he kind of lost his chance, I think, to cut this off early on. And then the idea of peer mediation is, while it can be a useful tool when kids are similarly situated and are equals, in a situation with a bully, the problem is that the bully will come into the room and say what an adult wants to hear in the moment, but then, you know, turn around and take it out on this weaker child as soon as they walk out the door. So that's why it's not a good idea to use it in bullying situations. And then when Monique's mother and grandmother started to speak out, you could expect that to be a moment in which the community, you know, took on the protection of this child. But unfortunately, in this town, the school board and the superintendent reacted very defensively. And instead of really hearing what Monique's mother was saying, I think they started blaming her instead. And so it's an unfortunate example of how adults can turn what should be a small private dispute among children into a kind of much larger disaster.
Chuck, what's a family to do?
Well, I think that the most important thing a family can do is to arm itself with information. You know, when you're informed and knowledgeable about what bullying is, what it isn't. For example, most parents should know that most states have laws on the books that say that school districts have to have effective anti-bullying policies. For example, we know that New Jersey has one of the most severe. New Jersey has the Anti-Bullying Bill of Rights, which states that if they don't effectively implement anti-bullying programs, and if it's found that a teacher was not effective in intervening, they could lose their teaching license. So I think that parents should not give in and be resigned to, you know, the rhetoric of I can't do anything or I talk to them or what more should I do. They should say, what is your anti-bullying program and is it effective? Let me see some research. What are the outcomes? Are the students involved in creating those plans and programs? Because we need to have students take ownership of that. That's where the buy-in is, and it really impacts the culture. So the culture has to be affected in some way, and Emily sort of touched upon that. You want to do peer-to-peer kinds of mediation things, but it's not something that's a part of the culture, then it's not going to work. And this sort of gets to the dysfunction that we find in education in general, right? So I have a joint appointment in psychology and education at Drexel. So when I put on my education hat and we talk about principals without power and superintendents being defensive, that's an issue across the board in education, bullying notwithstanding, which we're trying to tackle from Philadelphia to New Orleans. So.
And often teachers, superintendents get bullied by, you know, school boards.
Right. And politicians.
And politicians,
right.
and vice versa. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to take more calls. And I want to talk about who is at risk to bully, be bullied. And I want to talk more about what can be done, what we're really learning about it. We're talking about bullying with Emily Bazelon. She's a senior editor at Slate and a professor. Chuck Williams, as you just heard, he's a teaching professor both with the Department of Psychology and Education at Drexel. And we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. 888-477-9499. 9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
The Richard A. Reif Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack strikes, cardiac specialists know it's survival of the fastest. At Doylestown, they've worked to streamline every step of the treatment process, striving for faster care, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Located on West State Street in Doylestown, the Heart Institute is now easily accessible via the Route 202 expansion. Details at dh.org/heart.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about bullying, what it is, what it isn't, and what interventions are needed. My guests are Emily Bazelon and Charles Williams. Chuck, we got a message during the break from a listener who wanted to know, understand a little more about what bullying is not.
I think that's, again, very important because in this new environment where we need to talk about this issue, we should be very clear to delineate, you know, bullying from just inappropriate childhood or even appropriate childhood aggression. Let's be clear. Children are developmentally at a place where they're going to test boundaries. They're going to test each other. They're going to form allegiances and cliques, and they're going to do teasing and name calling. All of that isn't necessarily bullying. We need to address it in some instances, but bullying is persistent. It's often chronic. They enlist the support of their peers. They feel isolated and not supported either by peers or adults. And they feel all alone. As Rose mentioned, one of her callers, she felt like no one was listening to her. So from time to time, for the parents who are listening, if you hear that someone, for example, pushed your son or pushed your daughter, that's not necessarily bullying unless it's every day, every week, chronic and persistent, and no one is really intervening.
We've been talking about bullies a little bit. I want to talk more about bullies and the bullied. Emily, I want to talk to you about an experience you had with your friend Allie, who was bullied. You were right there with her. You were the one who had to watch this horrible event take place with your probably closest friend at the time. And you didn't do anything. What were you, in eighth grade? What was the impact on you, short term, long term?
Well, I think I'm very aware of that moment of cowardice. I remember kind of freezing instead of going to Allie's aid or in any way confronting the bullies. And I think that's part of my just interest in writing this book, because I want to help other kids figure out how to respond better. And also, as a parent, my kids are 10 and 13 now. I'm very aware that these are ever-present challenges of childhood. You know, one thing that's really striking about kids who are bystanders, so it almost all the time bullying takes place in front of an audience, but kids intervene only in about 1 out of 5 cases. When they do intervene, however, they are able to stop the bullying about half the time. And so that suggests there is this opportunity here, but then we need to figure out how to make this realistic for kids, how to reward them for, you know, defending victims as opposed to becoming more popular by being a bully. And then I think it's also important to give them strategies that don't rely on them confronting a bully in the most tense moment. That's actually quite a lot to ask. I mean, obviously, I don't want to discourage kids, but there are other ways that you can help targets of bullying by going up to them afterward, asking if they're okay, by sending a sympathetic text message, things that may be more realistic to ask of kids who are not super assertive and popular themselves.
So, Emily, I've got bad news for you. Heart and soul, I'm a clinician. You know, I'm just a shrink who sees people. So that's the way my mind works.
Uh-huh.
So do you mind if we go back to eighth grade for a minute?
Not at all.
All right. So I noticed that you were there and Allie was being bullied, and here we are years later, and you called it an act of cowardice. And I want to know what went on inside of you while that was happening.
I think I just knew I was scared in that moment. It was very public. The kids who were attacking her and yelling at her, it was a verbal bullying as opposed to physical, seemed scary to me in that moment. And it would have taken a real act of will to stand up to them. I think I knew or felt strongly that I was going to be the next object of humiliation, and I just wasn't strong enough to put myself in that position.
And how long did your self-criticism last?
Well, that whole period of eighth grade was just miserable for me. And I think I emerged from it with this real sense that I wasn't sure that people liked me, that they were really ever going to be my friends. Our caller, Rose, I think, talked about this a little bit, too. And my parents were very helpful and did help bolster my sense of self-worth. But it took me a long time, and I think it's still the case that I don't take other people's goodwill for granted. I kind of emerged from that situation feeling like it's a pleasant surprise when social interactions go well.
Chuck is sitting across from me, nodding and smiling. Put that into words, Professor.
Well, the clinical side in me sort of jumps out, and you know, some of those words are very, very powerful. Like, I didn't think, you know, people liked me, or I was afraid that if I did stand up, being a bystander, that they would then attack me, and then for sure I would know that they didn't like me. We all know that we are social beings, and probably the greatest pain or discomfort that we can experience as human beings, regardless of where we are in the world, is being ostracized from the group.
Shame. Right.
Shame, right?
Right?
So that's one of the reasons why bullying can be so powerful in a damaging kind of way. Because what it does, and Emily talked about this, particularly as it relates to females and relational aggression, and this year I'll be speaking at the National Girls Bullying Conference in Vegas talking about this, is they're really good at, you know, sort of getting them to be torn apart from the group. And as you know, developmentally, that group is your world. So if you feel like you no longer belong, and it's like, you know what? Maybe it's not worth it, and that's where we see the suicidal ideation.
Emily, tell us about the bullies. You know, the mantra is hurt people, hurt people. Is that hold up in your observations and research about bullies?
I really think there are different types of bullies. So there are kids, and we talked about this briefly before, who are both bullies and victims. And for them, you know, they tend to have a lot of trouble in their social relations. They often have difficult family lives. For them, I think the bullying is much more a cry for help. They're lashing out. Sometimes they're doing the dirty work for the real bullies, leaders. So those kids, yes, I think fit with what you're saying. But there are also kids who are bullies because they're being manipulative and they think this is the route to becoming more powerful and more popular. And it isn't for them about being, you know, suffering inside so much as using aggression as a tool.
And Chuck, I would think that latter group are the ones who have difficulty as they age.
Right, and that group that Emily mentions, and this is hard to say, but it's true, they enjoy the pain caused by bullying and the power psychologically that they have over the individual and the group. And my guess is, as I wrote here in my notes, they're probably hurting. You said hurt people, hurt people. They're probably hurting, and they're acting out that pain, obviously in a very inappropriate way. And we probably may find issues like conduct disorder, as you know, some personality disorder kinds of things later in life. So that's other reason why we have to address both bully and victim.
And how do we do that? How do we address bully? Emily, I'm thinking about the former group, the original group, about people who are suffering and do it to act out their own suffering, that this is a group who's in pain and they have access to their own insecurity. I would think it would be somewhat easier to help them.
Right. Well, you would hope so, but it also just depends whether kids are ready to really let people help them and whether they can be correctly identified and whether there are resources for helping them, which is often a tremendous challenge in schools. You know, we are asking a lot of schools right now, and I think good educators want to take on these challenges of helping kids with character development. But I'm not sure we've really had the national conversation we need to have about whether schools have the resources to do that job right.
Chuck, what kind of resources do we need? You know, one of the things, and Al Banks, our producer, suggested this, I'm inclined to agree, that, you know, they're calling for something. And, you know, we say they're calling for attention, but what they're calling for is care, understanding, even love.
Right,
you know?
Right. And we don't talk about love, right?
Yeah, and how much money does that cost?
Well, now this gets to the area. If I am an expert in anything, and I don't like that word necessarily, but it's social and emotional learning and social skills, which Olvais, we all know he's the preeminent scholar on this internationally, talks about the role of social and emotional learning and social skills, and that's something that I talk about a lot. So that's teaching kids how to respect themselves, right? And how to love themselves, how to build confidence, how to build assertiveness, you know, how to be able to appropriately navigate their social milieu, how to become their best advocates. And that's not that expensive. We could tack that on to a math lesson or a science lesson, but it's about what we value.
Yeah, because that's not expensive. It requires an attitude. Let's go to the phones. We've got Jennifer on the line. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hi.
I have been teaching preschool for well over 10 years, 3- and 4-year-olds. And what I've observed is that I have seen children that I can think that they are probably going to be bullied in their future. And it's sadly because often they have personality traits that make them stand out. They may be that they kind of tend to bother other children or poke at other kids. And even the nicest children eventually become, they almost start to circle them and pick back at them. And I can think, wow, these kids are going to eventually, people are going to turn on them, even though the children that are probably going to be bullied are nice children. They're nice children. They don't have the social skills to interact with other children. And as a teacher, we really work hard at the 3- and 4-year-old level to help them interact and help them become better members of the community. But I was wondering if there are any kind of studies or anything that is going on to look at children, even at that age, and maybe follow some of these kids that I can certainly walk into my classroom and almost pinpoint some of these children.
I would like you to have more than studies. I'd like you to have tools, and I'm going to turn to Chuck here and see what's out there for Jennifer.
Well, Jennifer touched on something that's sad but true, which is the research is showing that bullying is now starting in pre-kindergarten, at pre-K. We're seeing cases of that, and it's becoming an issue. She's also talking about some of the literature on temperament from people like Thomas and Chess, where you can see kids who seem to be socially awkward, withdrawn, not fitting in. Again, I got to go back to social skills. I've done some of this work. We have a researcher by the name of Myrna Shore, just happens to be a Drexel, but I've used her work in my own research and in my clinical work when I was doing it. ICPS, it's I Can Problem Solve, and it starts from kindergarten through middle school. And you can use this curriculum in kindergarten to work with kids, and it teaches them how to recognize their feelings, someone else's feelings, how to recognize when someone is upset, when they're having a bad day, and how to help. Once again, not very expensive, but we have to have the will. We have to realize that education is about more than reading, math, and science.
Jennifer, I sure hope that was helpful. Emily, are you aware of other tools out there that could help Jennifer?
You know, there are a number of programs that start in elementary school. One called Steps to Respect or Second Step that is pretty easy for teachers to use out of the box. But I think this issue of preschool is really important, and I'm not surprised that you feel like you can already identify the kids you think are at risk of bullying. You know, one of the most important things that preschool teachers can do is help kids try to just learn the basics of, you know, getting along and how to manage conflict.
I also want to add on before we take our break. I also want to add on that the Southern Poverty Law Center has many curricula out there, wonderful ones about teaching tolerance. I don't know if it goes as low as pre-K, but it's worth taking a look at. They are a tremendous resource, and they're free. Southern Poverty Law Center. And so thanks for your call, and boy, am I glad that your kids have such a perceptive and caring teacher. We're talking about bullying today with Emily Bazelon and Charles Chuck Williams. Emily Bazelon is senior editor at Slate, and she's written Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. And that's what I want to talk about when we come back, empathy. Chuck Williams is an educational psychologist, and he's a teaching professor at both the departments of psychology and education at Drexel University. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday morning, February 27th from 9 to 11 a.m. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Registration now open for summer reading and writing program.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with Emily Bazelon and Charles Williams about the whole issue of bullying. I want to go right to the phones because we've got so many people who want to join the conversation. Let's start with Beth. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I am a mother of two teenagers and a former teacher. I moved on from my last job when my daughter was being bullied in that school and went to the adults, my bosses, and didn't get any attention for her issues. So we moved to a different school. But as my child has aged, social media has become an issue. They obviously want to be involved. Their friends are all involved in it. But as a teacher, I know that as adults, we only understand the tip of the iceberg. These kids are really good at working in and around any parental controls. They're so good at it. They learn so much quicker than we do about the ins and outs of it. And it is so pervasively, relentlessly difficult when bullying starts on social media. It's nonstop. It's 24 hours a day, and it goes everywhere. What do the experts suggest as a parent, as a teacher, that I do for my teenagers to keep them both involved in it but safe? Because, you know, you want them to make their mistakes under your watch, not when they're older.
Emily, so, Emily, I know you looked into Facebook. They even let you observe some of their methods of policing its users. What did you learn from Facebook?
Well, you know, so on Facebook, officially speaking, bullying and harassment are a violation of the site's rules. But there is a very heavy volume of complaints coming into Facebook. A lot of it's bullying, then there are also complaints about hate speech. And they have a relatively small number of employees who are going through these complaints. So that means they are doing it extraordinarily quickly, and they sometimes miss things. That happened the day that I was there. I was asking them about a particular group page on Facebook called Let's Start Drama that had caused enormous trouble at Monique's school, and one of the educators there had filed multiple complaints with Facebook, but 6 months later the page was still up, and it turned out that Facebook had just essentially missed his complaints. So that is one kind of question mark. I think, you know, in terms of guidance, I would say that it's so important to guide your kids through the beginnings of social media and through getting a phone. These are brand new modes of communication. And so, you know, the same way I wouldn't just open the door at midnight and ask my kid to go for a walk by himself, I also feel like I should be helping him figure out how to navigate all of this. And it's always so much easier to start stricter and then ease up later. So in the beginning, when, you know, your child gets his first cell phone and is sending text messages or signs up for his first social media account, I think that's the best moment to say, look, this is a new world you're entering, and I want to make sure that you get it and are doing it in a way that you can handle it. So I'm going to have your password. I'm going to look in the beginning and see what you're doing. And then, as you know, your kid shows that you can trust them, and then you can sort of ease up. But it seems to me that if you set the norm in the beginning, you have a better chance of having some oversight at a key moment.
Chuck, you want to weigh in on that?
I do. This goes back again to this larger conversation that we're having about violence, and particularly media violence, things like violent video games. You'd be surprised to know that part of the major issue is that parents don't have conversations with their kids about the dangers of things like social media. For example, far too many very, very, very young kids, I'm talking 7, 8, 9, 10, have cell phones. Why? There's no law that says every kid has to have a cell phone, because then you're opening them up to all types of dangers. But I think the most important thing, again, is about, you know, knowledge is power, educating your kids about the dangers of being on social media, and then, you know, setting boundaries and limits and saying that, well, I'll allow my 13-year-old but not my 9-year-old because you're too young or you're not ready to handle that.
Wait a minute. Both of you are assuming that parents know what the hell they're talking about.
Right. And that's why I said knowledge is power. So you want to educate yourselves about some of these things.
I mean, where am I going to go look? How am I going to get educated?
There are all kinds of websites. I think Emily.
No, I mean, I think that this is that parents sometimes tend to throw up their hands more than is really necessary.
I agree.
This is not rocket science. Right. If your kid is spending a lot of time on Facebook or Instagram, you can go on and figure out the basics of it. It is.
Right.
I think that we sort of have this notion that this is something that our generation of parents, which didn't grow up with this technology, cannot figure out. I am no technical wizard, believe me. But I understand the basics of how these sites work because I feel like I need to understand what my kids are doing.
And it's a safety issue. I tell parents, if you're going to be lax enough to allow your 7-year-old to have an Instagram and a Facebook and a Twitter and a cell phone, then install software that allows you to monitor everything that happens. When they're 7, 8, or 9, you have that responsibility.
Well, that's a parenting responsibility,
right,
to learn. We did a show on this several years ago, and the researcher described digital immigrants and digital natives. And, you know, parents' generation are digital immigrants.
Right.
And, you know, so it's our responsibility now to learn the culture, learn the language.
And I say that to educators and counselors as well as parents. It's part of our responsibility. Just like we used to say to our kids, you know, when you get to a red light, you stop. Yellow, caution, green, go. Stop sign, the same thing. A scary guy comes up to you, don't say anything, scream and run. This is a new world. So therefore, you have to learn new strategies because the dangers are new. It's no excuse not to be effective at parenting.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Emily on the line. Emily?
Hello.
Hi.
My husband is a teacher. We've been talking about holding teachers accountable in this country a lot. And you guys mentioned earlier that there are laws for teachers in schools about bullying programs. You talked a little bit recently about parent involvement, but instead of talking about protecting our kids, why don't you talk about making the teachers, or the parents of the bullies, accountable for their children?
Yeah, what is around for bullies, and what is effective there? Emily, let's start with you. What's your research show?
Well, parents of bullies are a key part of the problem, but they are a quite tricky part of the problem because you know, there's only a certain amount that other parents and even schools can do about adults who are not themselves necessarily at fault. That's a kind of tricky situation. And so, you know, parents often ask, should I go to the parents of the kid who's acting like a bully and try to get help from them? And my feeling is that if you know those parents are trustworthy and could be helpful, that can be a good idea. Sometimes people need to be told what their kids are doing, and then they'll hold them accountable. But other times, parents are part of the problem, and it can actually make things worse to try to resolve the dispute that way.
Yeah, my grandson was bullied, and it turns out that the boy who bullied him would have been really injured terribly if his parents were called by the principal. So it's, you're right, it is complicated, Chuck.
Yeah, and sadly enough, you'll find in far too many instances that the impetus for the bullying are the parents. That you had parents encouraging their kids, especially in the instance of social aggression with girls. And beyond that, and I'm sure all of us would agree, this conversation also includes what parents teach their kids about how to handle difference and diversity. And that's where the work of the Anti-Defamation League and the No Place for Hate campaign, I've worked with them here in Philadelphia and Barry Morrison, because a lot of it is, if you teach your kid to dislike a certain group, that's going to carry over to the schoolyard and the school bus and the classroom and the cafeteria. So part of this, again, as you mentioned, is about teaching tolerance and respect and appreciation for difference and diversity.
Yeah. I want to come back to the question about who is, and I'll turn to you, Emily, who's at more risk for being bullied and what can parents do? You know, we know about gays and lesbians are at more risk. Who else did you find in your research?
Well, that is an important group. And then kids with disabilities are at an increased risk, whether they're physical disabilities or learning disabilities. When kids are in a religious minority at a school, that can be an issue. A lot of Muslim and Sikh kids have been bullied in the wake of 9/11. And then the other big category, or one other big category, is appearance. And so kids get bullied for being overweight frequently. And in middle school and high school, there is a fair amount of what is called slut shaming going on, where girls who are seen, whatever they're doing, if they're seen as being with different boys, they can be attacked for that.
And at the same time, there's pressure on girls to have sex before they're ready.
Right.
Yeah, that's a horrible position for girls to be in.
And the problem with GLBTQ youth, again, goes back to my previous point. If they're already told they're going to hell and God doesn't love them, and adults think that way, especially far too many of our politicians, then how do you say to a kid, respect someone, a kid who is gay or lesbian in that way? So again, it's about teaching respect and appreciation for diversity and people who may be different in lots of in various ways.
We've got Christopher on the line. Hey, Christopher.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? What can we do for you?
I hear all this talk. It seems like a really popular topic these days. I hear all this talk about bullying among kids. I never hear anything about adult bullying. I am a victim of adult bullying. I've been living in an apartment in Philadelphia. I'm 56 years old. I've been living in an apartment with a man who's 60 years old. We're not in an intimate relationship, which is share an apartment. But somehow he got it in his head that he has the right, whenever he's in a bad mood, to just fly into a psychotic rage and beat the living daylights out of me. The first time he did this, I went to the Philadelphia police and reported it. They made me spend hours. They made me go downtown and spend hours at this building filling out forms, and I finally handed in the forms, and they said, well, okay, now you have to pay $40.
I
didn't have $40 on me.
Yeah, this.
And so
this,
they said, well, then you're SOL.
Christopher, this sounds like, even though you're not in an intimate relationship, it does sound like a case of pretty severe domestic abuse, and there are resources out there. I don't have any handy. I don't know if you, if you, Christopher, hang on the line. We're going to pull up some resources from past shows and get them to you post haste. I'm sorry for what you're going through, but there are resources available for you. Emily, I want to, as we wind down, I want to comment on something you said right in the introduction of your book. You said if real change can come from a concerted effort to stop bullying, there's also a risk that the search for solutions will end up doing more harm than good.
Right. So one outcome we don't want is to have adults policing kids to such a degree that they lose their freedom to grow. Kids have to be able to have conflicts. They have to practice that because adulthood is certainly not conflict-free. And they have to learn to deal with adversity. And so I think this goes back to Chuck's points carefully defining bullying, because bullying is a particular form of harmful aggression, and that's what we really need to be concerned about. Chronic psychological manipulation and real physical violence. So if we limit the definition in that way, then I think we can do a tremendous amount of good by working to prevent bullying. And we also make the problem more manageable and possible to address. But when bullying starts to appear everywhere and it becomes an excuse for adults to start censoring kids and to think that we have to overprotect them, that's the risk I was trying to warn of there.
So what's your prediction if you rewrite this book 10 years from now?
That's such a good question. You know, I hope that a lot of schools and communities will have really started changing their norms. And one of the examples from recent history that gives me a lot of hope is the battle to stop drunk driving among teenagers. When I was growing up, it was kind of cool to drive drunk. I hate to admit that, but I think that's how I felt as a teenager. When I ask teenagers and people in their 20s now, they look at me like I'm crazy. That's just not how they see it.
And I think that is a wonderful way to end the show, with a note of hope about, you know, drunk driving or smoking. The culture can change, it has changed, and hopefully it will again. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. It's been a very, very important and informative show, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure.
I've been talking with Emily Bazelon and Chuck Williams about bullying. Next week on Voices from the Family, we're going to be talking about new research on sexual hookups. Well, please comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices, where you can download this show or others on there or on iTunes. You can email me at drdangottlieb.com, and please follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And, oh, me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Hey, have a good week, my friends.